So this is the story of how I got to Malaysia. First I was staying in different Ajahn Chah associated monasteries, meaning they are not official branches of, you know, Wat Phapong. One exception is Tisarna, which is an official branch monastery. Tisarna is a monastery in Canada. Now, one such monastery I was staying at in Australia was called Wat Buddha Dhamma, which is to the north of Sydney in this beautiful national park. It's called Darug National Park. It's like kind of original, you know, native forest to Australia, which, you know, the white man never cut down. So it's very beautiful there. And while there, I met a man who had practiced in Sri Lanka for several years. And he used to be a monk. He was a Westerner, but ordained in a Sri Lankan tradition. That tradition's called Galdua. And they are, they have different ways of doing things than the Ajahn Chah lineage, and he was telling me about it. And his name was Zen, this young man from Britain. His full name is Zenor, Z-E-N-O-R, which is a totally weird Western name, but Zen for short. And one of their neat things they do is they have this solo retreat area in this big monastery where he stayed. Meaning, like, the monks have a very free, open schedule. They get to meditate all day long. You only have a little bit of chores to do every day, just, you know, 10, 15 minutes worth of chores. And you go for alms round in the village, one meal a day, but then the rest of the time is for you. So that sounded wonderful. I was really kind of looking for something like that. And at that time, I had 7 years seniority. Right now, I have 11. So this is like 4 years ago. And now he wanted to go back there again and ordain. He wanted to return to Sri Lanka. Like, he was, you know, wanting to make another go at being a monk. And so we sort of banded together. And I'm like, well, I'd like to go there and go to this solo retreat here. Why don't we go together? And then there was a third Australian man, a young man named Bryce, and he wanted to ordain as well. So we all banded together and we went to Sri Lanka. And we flew on the plane together, and Zen knew some Sri Lankan people already, so he was able to arrange a ride. That was awesome, because the bus system is actually really hard to understand if you can't speak Sinhalese. Like, it's not like Malaysia where a lot of people can speak English. Like, you know, if you don't know Sinhalese, you better have some friends, yeah, because it's hard. Like, it's, yeah, like, a lot of the signs are not in English, and anyway, I'm really grateful to this Zen man for taking me to Na Uyana, and so the monastery I went to is called Na Uyana, and they've got about 150 monks. Actually more now, more like 170 plus now, but back then 150 bhikkhus. In it, that monastery is famous for being the biggest meditation monastery in all of Sri Lanka, like where the monks are actually meditating. And the monastery is split into three areas. So they have the so-called lower monastery. That's kind of where all the junior monks tend to be to just get a basic training. And the library's there, the Sima Hall is there. All the communal things happen there, the big communal things. The Padimokkha rest station is there. So I had to stay there for the first week or two because they didn't know me, really. They knew I was an Ajahn Chah monk, so they could trust my Vinaya was the same as theirs, very similar. But of course, when you're a strange monk, they, you know, they kind of want to get to know you. And then once they, you know, felt more comfortable with me, then I requested permission to go stay in that solo retreat area, and I had to have an interview with a senior monk there, a very senior monk, and yes, he would let me do it, and he wanted to know just what kind of style of meditation I did and everything. But I got the permission, and so that was awesome. I loved living in this solo retreat area. This was the first time I'd ever been to Asia, by the way, in my whole life. Like, I never even came to Asia as a layperson. I would have been, 30, 39 at the time, 39 years old at that time, and first time to Asia ever. So it was a really big culture shock. Like, I'm from Canada, and Canadian culture and Sri Lankan culture, like, they are very different, and the food is very different, weather's very different, you know, animals are different, everything's different. And it was very, yeah, and the culture, very different. But the practice was great, and it made it worth it, and I'm really glad I went. And that was a time where I think my practice matured the most out of my whole monk life up to that point. And so, yeah, I feel a real sense of, you know, a debt of gratitude to them for that opportunity, because it's actually rather hard to get this kind of an arrangement in the Ajahn Chah lineage, where you're staying in a monastery, you have very light duties, you're getting fed every day, you know, you have a wide open schedule. How it usually works in the Ajahn Chah lineage, if you want that, you can have it, but you have to go on tudong. Like, you have to take your, you know, big kind of umbrella thing with the mosquito net and, you know, go off in the forest and do your own thing there. That's where you can have your solo practice. They're not really wanting you to do that in their monastery. Like, they have kind of a standard that everyone has to all work a certain amount, and, you know, I guess they want it to be fair. Like, everyone should work fairly equally. You know, it's not really fair for someone to have a long, long retreat, at least someone who's not a really senior monk. Like, they feel you need to be a really senior monk kind of before you deserve that. But Naoyana would let you have that even if you were a junior monk. But, and you would think a lot of those Sri Lankan monks would be just about, like, fighting each other to get this opportunity, right? Like, the Ajahn Chah monks would love to have this opportunity. It's almost criminal to get it, you know, from their point of view. But those Sri Lankan monks, actually, most of them did not want to go to this solo retreat area. They had enough kutis for maybe, like, 25 monks, but only about 10 or 12 of them were full. Like, just maybe over half kutis were full. There were empty kutis in this area. And I'm like, what? You know, you think there'd be a waiting list. You think there'd be competition for this, you know? But I guess when you are raised in a Sri Lankan culture, or I guess any traditional ethnic Asian culture, it's a very social culture, and you're used to being around other people all the time. You know, it's a very... people don't have much private time to themselves, or less anyway, than Westerners tend to have. And I think they all feel kind of some stronger social bonds that, like, when they're put in isolation, it's hard on them. It's weird and difficult, and, you know, like, they actually, it kind of scares them. Like a few monks came and they only lasted a few weeks, and they actually kind of got scared and went back to, like, another part of the monastery. I'm like, scared, you know, like, are you scared of the snakes or what? And they're like, no. Like, well, what? And, well, just the lack of social contact was too, somehow it was just psychologically difficult for them. But for me as a Westerner, I'm like, well, this is heaven. Like, I would love to do this forever. You know, this is, yeah. And there were indeed lots of, like, snakes and whatnot around, by the way. They had these, diamond head vipers, and I almost stepped on a couple of them, but didn't get bitten. Like, I'll just pause the story for a sec. Yeah, like, one time there was one coiled up, and, like, I didn't see it. I wasn't looking. Like, I had just a very brief slip in mindfulness, And as my foot was coming down, like, it was coming down right on the snake, and the snake, whoosh, like, zipped out of the way, and my foot landed right after that snake. You know, like a tenth of a second after that snake got out of the way. So that was, you know, that was very lucky for me. And there was another time where, like, there are these sort of cement steps that you walk down when you come out of your kuti. And the snakes love to coil up on the bottom stair because they it gets nice and warm on that concrete. And they like to lay in the sun. Like, they kind of coil up on your stair, like the bottom stair. In the sun. So I came out, and there was one on my stair, and I was kind of in a hurry to go, and to the next thing I had to go to, and And I stupidly thought, maybe I'll just sneak past it and he won't notice me. That was like totally stupid. But I was in a hurry and I just didn't think straight. In retrospect, I should have got a broom and kind of just swept him off of there. But anyway, I tried to sneak past him, just like a foot away. And then right when I was stepping right beside him, of course, he knew I was right there. And he sprung straight into the air, like a spring, like he was coiled up. And he went like boing, like he like popped up in the air, like about a foot off the ground. Yeah. Yeah, like he was scared, like, wow. Yeah. Like he... Now, thankfully, he didn't launch at my leg and bite it. You know what I mean? Like, he was just surprised. And then I jumped the other way myself. And then, he didn't bite me, but I startled the snake.
Was it a viper?
Yes, this is a diamond head viper. So you can die from one of these bites. Yeah. Oh. Actually, there was a Russian monk named Devamitta, Westerner, and he got two diamond head viper bites one evening. Like, he didn't have his flashlight and it got too dark, and he was just walking outside his kuti, and he just walked back to his kuti, just, you know, 50 steps, but he happened to step on a viper, bit him twice, and then and it's actually kind of far from any kind of hospital there, but they went to kind of the local snake doctor, and they gave him some kind of a, like, an Ayurvedic kind of a snake, you know, medicine, snake bite medicine, and then they also did a bunch of traditional chanting. Like, I guess they do these sort of like ritualistic chants, and anyway, his legs swelled up huge and it became black, and it hurt really bad, and only after about 4 days of staying with the snake doctor, only then would the snake doctor say, okay, I think you're going to survive through this. Like, for the first few days, when Devamitta asked, like, so am I going to survive? Like, the doctor would not answer. He wouldn't say yes or no because he didn't know yet. Only on about day four, he's like, yeah, I think you're going to live. And he did. And but yeah, it was like, it took 2 weeks, I think, for the pain to come down. And I saw him after the first week, and like his leg was like green. His leg was still green. Like, one leg looked normal and the other one was green. So anyway, that was serious. But yeah, he survived. Okay, anyway, back to my story. So now I did a lot of walking meditation during that time, and read suttas every day for about 20 minutes. I had a really good practice of, you know, like, I didn't have any sort of daily teacher there. Like, it's a solo retreat. You kind of run your own show there. So I would read the suttas for 20 minutes, and that was my teacher. You know, like, the Buddha was my teacher there. And, I really like the suttas for that. And, you know, to this day, I still try to keep this habit up of reading 20 minutes a day, reading the suttas. And anyway, I stayed there 15 months, and I would have stayed longer, but I developed digestive problems from the Sri Lankan food. Yeah, I couldn't really digest that food anymore. And I saw both Ayurvedic doctors and traditional Chinese doctors and Westerner doctors. I saw them all. And none of them could really help me other than to say, well, you know, this food isn't suitable for you. You really should go somewhere else where the food is more suitable. I even went to the hospital a couple of times. And anyway, so I asked the other Westerner monks, so what do you do? Because, you know, virtually all of them had digestive problems as well. Like 95% of them all had digestive problems from that food. And so I said, well, what do you do about this? And so what they would do when their digestion got too bad, they would come to a monastery here in Malaysia called Nandika, which is just over in Bukit Mertajam. And so then I learned about Nandika. And you know, I asked questions about it. There was a Canadian monk I met there. Yeah. And, you know, so he explained what Nandika was like, and yeah, sure, it sounded good. And so then I requested permission to go there, and they did agree to send me there eventually. And they even kind of recommended me to that abbot of Nandika. Like, they, you know, I got formally connected through the two abbots, you know, which is kind of the right way to do things. And they even paid for the plane ticket. And so that's how I first came to Malaysia. And then, I've been in and out of Malaysia a few times now, but now I'm staying here kind of a bit more long term. And so anyway, that's the story. Okay, now, I've got about 40 minutes left. I want to read a couple of suttas. And after I read these suttas, I want to delve into one of them that's kind of deeper and tell you kind of what my practice in Sri Lanka there was like, which was kind of like in this sutta, okay? All right, so I've picked two suttas from the Anguttara Nikaya. And now the first one is very sort of, it's short, it's inspiring, it's uplifting, it's, you know, this is kind of like a positive sutta. The second one's kind of a little more heavy. It's a little deeper. It's a little more, it's the kind of sutta you could take a whole lifetime to really kind of learn. Okay. So, all right, here's the first one. So this is actually three short suttas that are almost exactly the same. They just change one word pretty much. Okay. This is Anguttara Nikaya 1's 53 to 55. Okay, if bhikkhus, a bhikkhu cultivates a mind of loving kindness even as long as a finger snap, you know, like a finger snap, they're called a bhikkhu who does not lack absorption or jhana, who acts upon the teaching of the teacher, who responds to his advice, and who does not eat the country's alms food in vain. How much more then those who cultivate it? Cultivate loving kindness. Okay, and then the next sutta. If a bhikkhu develops a mind of loving kindness even as long as a finger snap, they're called a bhikkhu who does not lack absorption or jhana, who acts upon the teaching of the teacher, who responds to his advice, and who does not eat the country's alms food in vain. How much more then those who cultivate it? If bhikkhus, a bhikkhu focuses on a mind of loving kindness, even as long as a finger snap, they're called a bhikkhu who does not lack absorption or jhana, who acts upon the teaching of the teacher, who responds to his advice, and who does not eat the country's alms food in vain. How much more then those who cultivate it? So this is a very, you know, I'm going to say a very charitable sort of sutta, saying, you know, any monk or even layperson, you know, if their meditation practice actually brings, you know, like a taste of the Dhamma where they feel a peace, or they feel you know, serenity, or they feel bliss, even for a finger snap, they are, well, if they're a monk, they are worthy of the alms food of the land. They're, you know, like that monk earned his food, basically, or that nun. They earn their food for even that much. So, and then how much more so is it meritorious if they actually develop that farther? You know, like, you know, don't stop there. If you just get a finger snap, obviously, can you do that all the time? Can you do it more often, right? So, this is a very inspiring sutta, you know, to try to revisit, you know, maybe. I'm sure some people here have been on meditation retreats. Yeah, who here has been on a meditation retreat? Okay, most of the hands are going up here. Okay, majority anyway are going up. And and it is often the case, you know, maybe after going on one or two or three or, you know, maybe a few of these retreats, you know, then one starts to get a taste of this Dhamma where you actually start feeling peaceful and blissful in your meditation. And yeah, that's this sutta is saying, like, you, even that little, no matter how little that was a taste of jhana, maybe a mild one, but that is a taste, and that's very meritorious. So this is a compliment for those, you know, for that kind of merit. That's a compliment. Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to read. Okay, this is the heavier sutta. So this one's very much aimed at bhikkhus. And this is the kind of sutta where only after years and years am I kind of humbly agreeing, yes, it is exactly like this, and there's sort of no getting around what this sutta is trying to teach me, you know? Like, there is no, how can I put it? There is no shortcut. It has to be done in a gradual way, like this sutta is saying, you know, and it takes time. It can take a long time. It can take decades. Okay, so this is Anguttara Nikaya 4.178, and it's called the Reservoir. The Reservoir. This is one of my very, very favorite suttas, and I've been coming back to this one for a long time. Yeah. Okay. Now, if you don't know what a reservoir is, it means like a giant tank of water. And usually, like, the top of it is open to the air. Like, when you go to the botanical gardens here, if you walk right to the back, there's a big reservoir there. It's like a water supply. Okay? All right. Okay, bhikkhus, there are four kinds of person found existing in the world. What four? One, here a bhikkhu enters and dwells in a certain peaceful liberation of mind. He attends to the cessation of existence. As he is doing so, his mind does not launch out toward it, acquire confidence, become steady, and focus on it. This bhikkhu cannot be expected to attain cessation of personal existence. Suppose a man were to grab hold of a branch with his hand smeared with gum, like a sticky, gluey, you know, gum. His hand would stick to it, adhere to it, and be fastened to it. So too, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in a certain peaceful liberation of mind. He attends to the cessation of existence. As he is doing so, his mind does not launch out toward it, acquire confidence, become steady, and focus on it. This bhikkhu cannot be expected to attain the cessation of personal existence. Okay, number two, like type of person number two. Here, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in a certain peaceful liberation of mind. He attends to the cessation of personal existence. As he is doing so, his mind launches out toward it, acquires confidence, becomes steady, and focuses on it. This bhikkhu can be expected to attain the cessation of personal existence. Suppose a man were to grab hold of a branch with a clean hand. His hand would not stick to it, adhere to it, or be fastened to it. So too, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in a certain peaceful liberation of mind. He attends to the cessation of personal existence. As he is doing so, his mind launches out toward it, acquires confidence, becomes steady, and focuses on it. This bhikkhu can be expected to attain the cessation of personal existence. Okay, number three, like type of person number three. Here, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in a certain peaceful liberation of mind. He attends to the breaking up of ignorance. As he is doing so, his mind does not launch out toward it, acquire confidence, become steady, and focus on it. This bhikkhu cannot be expected to attain the breaking up of ignorance. Suppose there were a reservoir many years old. A man would close off its inlets and open up its outlets, and sufficient rain would fall. So inlets means sort of like the channels that water enters the reservoir, you know, like kind of water flows into the reservoir through the inlets. And then the outlets are the channels where the water goes out of the reservoir. It's kind of like the output, you know? Okay, and then, okay, so I'll just say that last sentence again. Suppose there were a reservoir many years old. A man would close off its inlets and open up its outlets, and sufficient rain would fall. In such a case, it could not be expected that this reservoir's embankment would break. The reservoir's embankment, like kind of the barrier around the top, would not break. So too, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in a certain peaceful liberation of mind. He attends to the breaking up of ignorance. As he is doing so, his mind does not launch out toward it, acquire confidence, become steady, and focus on it. This bhikkhu cannot be expected to attain the breaking up of ignorance. All right, number four. So person number four. Here, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in a certain peaceful liberation of mind. He attends to the breaking up of ignorance. Suppose there were a reservoir many years old. A man were to open up its inlets and close off its outlets, and sufficient rain would fall. Okay, so this man did the opposite. So he opened up the inlets, so it allows water in. He closes off the outlets, so the output can't get out. Like, the water cannot flow out. And sufficient rain would fall. In such a case, it could be expected that this reservoir's embankment would break. So the barrier around the top would break and all the water would, you know, like smash it all open. Okay, so too, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in a certain peaceful liberation of mind. He attends to the breaking up of ignorance. As he is doing so, his mind launches out toward it, acquires confidence, becomes steady, and focuses on it. This bhikkhu can be expected to attain the breaking up of ignorance. These bhikkhus are the four kinds of persons found existing in the world. Okay, so this is a deep sutta, and these analogies are actually very profound, because I think this is one of the more rare suttas which, now to me, I think what these analogies are really explaining well is the relationship between sense restraint and then how far your practice goes along. You know, when you're doing good meditation, you're having deep meditation, you're getting jhanas, this sort of thing. But sense restraint factors into that, and it factors into whether a monk is going to, you know, end, you know, personal existence, like the cessation of personal existence. That's kind of another way of saying nibbana, to attain nibbana. And also the breaking up of ignorance. And to me, that's sort of like being able to carry some sort of brahmavihara at least all the time. You know, having some sort of a brightness of heart all the time. And the more often a monk can do that, you could say they are breaking up the ignorance. Like, there are less and less periods of time where they don't have any of that brightness of heart. You know what I mean? More and more of their life has that brightness in it when they are breaking up the ignorance. So, you know, they want to have that all the time, like 100% of the time, some kind of brightness of heart or other. And to me, that's a good definition of what Nibbana would look like. You know, it's not just the case that monks can attain jhanas or attain to loving kindness, but can they keep a brightness of heart all day long? All day long. Some sort. Might be metta, might be equanimity, might be compassion, you know, could be mudita, but something. Could be serenity. You know, it's something that has that heavenly brightness to it all the time. And then you could say they've defeated ignorance. That to me is kind of a working definition of what Nibbana would look like. And then, of course, during formal meditation, jhanas are, like, not just, you know, regular, but downright easy. You know, it's very accessible to them. Yeah, now, okay, so I just want to return to this simile of the man grabbing hold of a branch. So in one case, his hand is smeared with gum, so it's sticky. In the other case, his hand is clean and doesn't stick to the branch. And to me, you know, like I ask myself, okay, well, what is he referring to when he talks about the hand being sticky with the gum. Like, what is that sticky gum? And to me, that's when a monk doesn't have very good sense restraint and doesn't have very good faith, and they kind of keep going back to sensuality in different ways. Maybe not ways which break Vinaya, but just those little things that they're not really letting go. Maybe they're not letting go of their old habits. They're not really letting go of their old ways of thinking. You know, they're not letting go of maybe like worldly kind of political things they believe in. Even though it's good karma to want to help the world, but it's still something on their mind. It's something they have emotions all kind of tangled up around. You know what I mean? And due to that tangled up, you know, those emotions being wrapped up in that, to me, that's like the gum being on one's hand, and now one's hand will stick. You know, like anything in the world that one still has got like emotional bonds to, you know, either positive or negative. You know, for me, like maybe it's something like really good sushi. You know, I used to love to eat sushi when I was in Canada. I lived in Vancouver for 3 years, and on my way to work, there was this one street where there was a bunch of sushi restaurants all clustered together. There's a lot of Chinese immigrants in Vancouver and Japanese too, and these restaurants would compete with each other. So they always had a lunch special. So you could eat sushi like pretty much every day. You got the lunch special, and it was affordable, you know. So yeah, I loved the sushi, but and there was this one item on the menu I loved the most. It was called the spicy tuna cone, and when I was at Nandika, there was this one man who, he took me out for sushi. This one, Dayaka took me out for sushi. And I could have ordered that spicy tuna cone. It was on the menu. I'm just like, don't do it. Don't order it. You know, like, come on. You know, there's 50 other things on here that are going to be delicious. Don't get that thing you love. Because then you're not working. You're not like trying, you know what I mean? Like, and it was, that took major willpower, and I didn't order that spicy tuna cone. to my credit, that it was hard to do, you know. So whatever we still like, you know what I mean? If we keep sort of feeding that emotional bond, then we're going to still have stickiness towards it. Like that emotional bond, I say, is the stickiness, and just how it gets stuck in our minds as well. Like it pops into our heads, you know, whatever we like, that thing pops into our head. And then your mind is much less peaceful because this thing keeps popping back into our minds. Or if we dislike something, you know, like maybe there's a certain political leader we don't like, or maybe there's a certain political cause we really believe in, and we feel kind of angry that people don't care as much as we care, you know, and it might be a good cause, it might actually be worthy, but, you know, if you're a Buddhist monk and you're trying to attain Nibbana, like lay people, this is totally okay. By all means, go eat sushi if you like it. You're lay people, that's fine, you know, or if you want to, you know, support some political leader or oppose some other political leader you don't like, that's fine with me. You know, that's kind of a layperson's domain, you know. But when you're a monk and you're trying to attain Nibbana, this, you can't attain Nibbana until you, even these things have to be removed. And like, I'm not even breaking Vinaya. You know, like if I'm offered a spicy tuna cone, I can eat it, not break Vinaya. As long as that fish is not raw, by the way. If you ever take a monk out for sushi, by the way, if you bring a lighter along with you, there's a loophole in the Vinaya. If you light the lighter and you burn the raw fish for even just a few seconds, many communities would say, oh, that's not raw anymore. So that no breakage of vinaya. Like, it's actually a dukkha offense for a monk to eat raw meat. Yeah. Right, so whether a monk's hand is sort of gummy or not matters here. Even though in all four of these cases, the monk is entering and dwelling in a peaceful liberation. All four cases. You see, like, isn't he praiseworthy for getting into any peaceful liberation? He should be praiseworthy, right? Just like in my first sutta that I read out. You know, like, wow, you know, you deserve your alms food if you can even get a finger snap of loving kindness. You know, that's actually praiseworthy. But then this sutta is coming along and saying, okay, now let's balance out that very charitable sutta. And, you know, this one's a little more, what's the word? Demanding of personal responsibility out of the monks. Saying, like, look, you're never going to get your work done unless you figure out your hand can't be sticky. You must restrain your senses. You must come out of these, you know, emotional bonds you've got with worldly things. You must come out of your attachments. And then your mind will be ready to launch out towards these peaceful liberations of mind. It'll launch out. It'll acquire confidence. It will become steady and focus on it. Like, it'll become natural and easy to keep doing that, keep staying with that. And it's not just a temporary little thing. You know what I mean? It's not like, you sit down and meditate, you have a nice peaceful meditation, but then you stand up and all of the peace is gone. You know, you just go back to kind of normal again. And you know what I mean? Like, the Buddha's saying, well, you're not going to be able to keep that peace with you. You know? Yeah. So, yeah. And same with this reservoir. Okay. So, you know, what are the inlets and outlets? That's actually kind of a profound thing to think about. Like, I had to think about this for a long time. And the way that I see it is, in the first case where the monk, you know, cannot be expected to attain the breaking up of ignorance. So he's doing things wrong. He closes off the inlets and he opens up the outlets. So it just lets the water out and no new water is really coming in. Although rain does rain in there, you know. So what that means to me, after thinking this over for many years, what it means to me is that rain raining into the reservoir, that is your formal meditation. That is when you can, you know, get some kind of a peaceful meditation, some Brahmaviharas, maybe even jhanas. So that's like rain. You know, like, there are actually many suttas where an analogy using water is used to talk about the jhanas, or, you know, like, that's like, it's there's water is oftentimes used to mean samadhi, something like that. But the inlets are closed off, meaning, like, oh, you could get more water, but you're not. The monk could, if he were doing things right, he would open those and you would get even more water. Okay? Now, so the monk doing it wrong, he shuts off those inlets and he opens the outlets, meaning water is escaping out of the reservoir. Let me return to the inlets. By closing off the inlets, what that means to me is this isn't being able to carry some sort of brightness of heart at all times outside of formal meditation, carrying loving kindness, carrying compassion, or carrying some, you know, serenity, something like this, equanimity. That would be an inlet which lets in more water into the reservoir. If they can even maintain that connection to the Dhamma, even outside of formal meditation. It's like extra adding to the reservoir. Okay? And then the outlets being open, to me, that is analogous to being lazy about sense restraint and allowing one's energy to sort of flow out into the world. like, if monks ever take up some sort of a hobby, let's say, maybe they like to do carpentry in their spare time, or maybe they like to create, like, kind of crafts that take a lot of time. You know, a lot of monks, well, maybe I won't go this far, but I'm just going to say some of them are into crafts, and it takes huge amounts of time to make these crafts. If I even said what the crafts were and they heard what I said, they would take offense, because they're like, yeah, but that's the tradition. But any sort of hobby, to me, it is a kind of blameworthy, just because you're letting your energy escape. You could have, you know, one needs to sort of garner one's energy. I don't know if you know this word, garner. It's sort of like G-A-R-N-E-R. Garner means like to gather in and to protect. Another good English word is marshal, to marshal one's energy. Like marshal means like to manage or to take control of, to take command of. So any way that one's energy flows out, it's like you're opening those outlets and you're letting the precious water get out of the reservoir. Even socializing with people, energy can, you know, just wasting time chit-chatting. That you can lose your energy that way too. There's lots of ways to lose energy when you're a monk. It's not just making crafts, you know, but like chit chat is one, like too much internet is another way. Even if you're not breaking Vinaya, you can just waste time reading Wikipedia articles about whatever. I'll confess to doing that one sometimes. Trying to do that less. Anyway, and now, person number four here in the sutta. So they do the opposite thing. They close the outlets, meaning they don't waste that energy anymore. They actually restrain themselves, and they open the inlets, meaning they can bring more peace into their life, because they're able to have more dhamma in their lives, not just during formal meditation, but also outside of formal meditation. Like even when they're, let's say, showering, or even when they're eating, or even when they're walking, or even when they are going to the bathroom. Everything. You know, that's when the practice is developed in every place and every time. So that's when this reservoir actually fills up enough and then breaks the embankment. So to me, the breaking of the embankment, that's sort of nibbana happening. That's attaining enlightenment. You know, sort of the that's where their mind it launches out towards this peace. It acquires the confidence. It becomes steady and focuses on it. And then it becomes kind of like a self-sustaining way of being. It just keeps flowing. It just keeps being natural. That's kind of their new normal. And they would never stop, because it feels so good. You know, like they've sort of overcome all their attachments, and now this is what their whole life is like now. So to me, that's kind of a nice way of explaining arahantship. Yeah. Okay. Now I'll just really briefly. Okay, so it's 10 to 11. It's 10 to 11. If anyone has to go, is a time to pause. Okay. Okay, and I'll just wrap it up in like 5 minutes. Now I want to just relate something very kind of nice. When I was in Sri Lanka, having all that free time to myself, a wide open schedule, that was a great time for me to bring mindfulness into every part of my day. And what I would do is, by default, I would just sit on a chair and meditate. And I would virtually never think to myself, or very little would I think to myself, so what do I need to do next? Like, what should I do now? Because the answer is always meditate. Like, the default thing was meditating. However, every once in a while, it would pop into my head something I do need to take care of. You know, without me really thinking. Like, it'd pop into my head, oh, you know, you haven't had a shower yet. And then I'd be like, okay, well, I do need to have a shower. But can I do it mindfully? And I would get up mindfully, and I would carefully go have the shower mindfully. You know what I mean? And then I would come back to the chair and sit down. And then, you know, just kind of be peaceful and mindful for the next 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever, or half an hour might fly by if it felt real nice. And then it would pop into my head the next thing to do, like, you haven't swept the floor today. You know, you haven't swept your kuti. And I'd be like, okay, well, all right, I'll do that, but can I do it mindfully? So then I would, each thing, I'd sweep mindfully. And then I would sit down again, and then I would just go back to a default of meditation. Just for whatever, 5-10 minutes, or whatever the time would go by. But what was so amazing was, it always kept occurring to me what the next activity was. You know, like, oh, I better take out that garbage in the kitchen, because there's some food scraps, and the ants are going to get in there if I don't take it out. You know, like something like that would occur to me. And I never had to really think. You know, and that to me was actually really beautiful, because it was very like kind of anatta. It was very kind of not self. You know, like normally how I live my life, or how I've lived it for the longest time before then, was, you know, I'm always asking myself, well, what's the next thing to do? What do I have to do next? And like, I really have to think hard, and I'm trying to make plans, and I'm making lists of things, and I'm, you know what I mean, trying to be organized, and I'm kind of scattered, you know, and I've got all these different priorities that are kind of like fighting with each other, you know what I mean? I'm sure you can relate to this. You know, when you have a busy life, you kind of have more things to do than you have time for, and you know what I mean? So there's a lot of mental overhead to that. You know, there's a lot of mental, lots of planning. And a lot of times the planning is excessive. And, this way of living was far more stress-free, because I would not plan at all. And just the essential things would occur to me. You know, it's like, did you brush your teeth yet? Well, okay, I have to brush my teeth, you know, so then I would do that, and I do it mindfully. And I became much better at bringing the mindfulness into my life. And it was really, really helpful to have a wide open schedule to do that. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't, like, normally how life in a monastery was for me was, there's actually quite a rigid schedule. You know, like, there's chanting, and then there's chores, and then there's breakfast, and then there's work period, and then there's lunch, and then there's, you know, like, there's always some sort of a program, and you just sort of move along with the program, and your mindfulness might actually be kind of poor as you do all those things. However, as long as you don't make any obvious displays of poor mindfulness, then everyone is okay with you. You know what I mean? As long as you're cooperating and you're going along with the schedule, then everyone's happy enough. And you know, as long as you're kind and respectful to the senior monks, and as long as your sila is decent enough, you know, obviously you do need to be real careful around sila, but you know, if you had those basics together, that was good enough. Even if your mindfulness was actually a little bit sloppy, actually mine was a lot sloppy. I was only able to keep my mindfulness before that time in Sri Lanka. I could only keep my mindfulness maybe like 20-30% of the time when I was not formally meditating. But then after living this lifestyle with the wide open schedule for like, you know, 15 months, when I came out of Sri Lanka, I could stay mindful like 70-80% of the time, like the majority. So that was a tremendous gain, And what I would also really attribute that to was Nauyana had a strict policy. The monks are not allowed to use internet while there. They had a monk who worked in the office, and if you wanted to send an email, you had to type the email on a computer which is not connected to the internet at all. Then you save the email as just like a text file or like a document. And at the top it says like to, you know, some address, you know, from, and then your name. And then the body of the message. And then that office monk, he would write email on your behalf. And he would put in the to address, but the from address would be the monastery. It's not from me, you know, my own email address, from their email address. And like, if you just sent a mail to your mother or something, you might not read her reply till like 2 weeks later, because you know, he might take a whole week before he takes that USB stick with your file and actually sends everybody's emails. And then when he gets the answer back, it might be a whole week before he actually prints the email from your mom. Like, he would print it on paper and then write your name on that paper and fold it up, you know? And then you would actually get your message, like, on paper. You actually, like, open it. It's like a message on paper. It took about 2 weeks to you know, like, round trip. You know, people here use WhatsApp, you know, like, instant, you know, like, you know. Anyway, but to me, that is how I closed those outlets in my life, because I was spending a lot of energy and time on the internet. A lot of my energy was being wasted on too much internet stuff. So for me to get offline for like about 15 months, that made a huge difference. Actually, you know, I actually did the right thing with this reservoir. You know what I mean? So like, I don't claim to be enlightened or anything, but it really made a difference. It really made a difference. So yeah, I closed that outlet in my life, which was internet stuff. And I opened the outlet where I was bringing more peace into my day, because I was doing everything more mindfully all day long as I took a shower or whatever it was. More and more peace was building up in my life. So that made a tremendous difference. Yeah. Now, of course, it is challenging. Like, now that I'm not in Sri Lanka anymore, I do have internet access, like, pretty much all the time. And it is easy to, once again, open up those outlets and kind of waste some time. I'm trying to get better at that. You know, like, it is kind of an ultimate test. Can I do this under my own willpower? You know, having access to it. How's my willpower? And I believe this is something I must perfect, is using my own willpower and not sort of relying on the crutch of the monastery just having a policy of no internet, like, chop, you get none. You know what I mean? Like, it's... you're not really using your willpower under those circumstances. You know, it's kind of just the monastery policy. But it does close the inlet. It does take willpower to go to the monastery, so that was good to develop that willpower. But it's kind of another level of willpower when you're living with this all the time and you are practicing restraint and you're just using the internet as you need to. It's hard to learn that. So, but I feel this is something I must learn. And, you know, even though my mindfulness is not as awesome as it was at that time in Sri Lanka, it's still pretty good, and it's still much better than before I went to Sri Lanka. Like, I still feel I have a profit that I came away with and kept, if you know what I mean. Yeah, so that time for me was unbelievably valuable to have, like, you know, basically be supported by a monastery for a long period of time and have a wide open schedule and develop that day-to-day awareness. And really, like, it's really beautiful to get into this mind space of there's kind of nobody there. You know, you're just mindful all the time. You're doing your object meditation and you don't really have any kind of sense of self. And you're not, you know, you don't have any agenda. You don't have any, you know. That was really, really great. Really great. So I'm really grateful to them. Okay, so I'm going to wrap this up real fast. It's almost 11. Yeah, so I guess I'll just do the... where'd my little notepad go? Okay. All right, so let's do the dedication of merit. Okay. Idang me punyang, asawa kaya wahang hotu, idang me punyang, nibanasa pachayo hotu, mama punya bagang, sabba satanang, bhajemi, te sabe, me samang, punya bagang, labantu.